Every now and then, this happens. Somebody comes along like Dale Brown, and I've been a I think that I've read almost every book he's written. I'm a total Dale Brown freak, so it's going to be tough. It's tough to interview somebody that you revere like this. Former U.S. Air Force Captain Dale Brown graduated from Penn State University with a degree in Western European history and received an Air Force commission in 1978. He was a navigator bombardier in the B-52G Stratofortress heavy bomber and the F-111A supersonic medium bomber. And it shows and shows in everything he's written. Dale is a multi-engine and instrument-rated private pilot and can often be found in the skies all across our great country piloting his own plane. He is the recipient of several military decorations, was also one of the nation's first Air Force ROTC candidates to qualify and complete the grueling three-week U.S. Army Airborne Infantry Paratrooper training course. Dale supports a number of organizations to promote law enforcement, education, and literacy. He is the author of 19 action-adventure techno-thriller novels with his latest, Strike Force. And at the moment, I'm about 7/8 of the way through his book, which I'm reading right now, called Edge of Battle. Dale Brown, coming up in a moment. What an absolute honor, Dale Brown. Welcome to Coast AM.
Thank you very much. It's great to be here again.
I'm just a monstrous fan, Dale.
Thank you.
Techno thrillers are my favorite, and you're like the top of the heap.
Thank you very much. That's a great tribute from you.
the first book I read was Flight of the Old Dog, and
that was 20 years ago. 20 years, almost to the day.
Oh, yeah.
20 years ago.
You flew B-52s, right?
Yes, I did.
So I sort of imagined, and of course I knew you did, but I imagined that as you wrote the book, you began to put things into B-52s that you could imagine and sort of smiled as you added them and modified them in your mind, yes?
This was in a day back in the late 70s, early 80s, when things like stealth technology and electronically scanned radars and GPS technology, satellite navigation technology, was just coming out. And the B-52 was a very popular test bed aircraft for this. You could load a B-52 up with all these gadgets and all this new technology. They had B-52s that were reskinned with this weird composite material. It wasn't made out of metal. It was made out of carbon, and it was made out of ceramics. And the B-52 was a perfect test bed for this. And we, just the line guys out there working on, doing the day-to-day flying, we heard little inklings of this stuff that that guys were flying B-52s into Edwards and other bases down in southern Nevada, and they were using them to test these weird new technologies. Mm-hmm. And we had no idea exactly what was going on, but we sort of began to project about, we saw a few pictures here and there in Aviation Week and space technology, what we called aviation leak, that they would get information about things that we would get classified briefings about 1 or 2 weeks later after it actually came out in the press. And so it was very easy to fantasize about what the B-52s were being involved with. And that's what got me going in the whole subject of us lowly B-52 guys. We weren't the F-15 Eagles. We weren't the F-4 Phantoms. We weren't the hot jets out there. But we were the B-52 guys. But the B-52s were being used for this top secret experimental stuff. And for a guy who always wanted to be a writer and always wanted to write fiction, it was a perfect breeding ground for stories.
Of course.
And that's how I got started.
Okay, let's come forward. Strike Force, the latest. What's that all about?
Strike Force is the one-line story for Strike Force is is with all the things going on between the United States and Iran right now, what if there was a military coup inside Iran? What if the regular military rose up against the Iranian Revolutionary Guards Corps? There is one general, one true leader inside the regular military who decided to stand up against the Revolutionary Guards Corps and try to take over the government. Would the United States support him? Exactly how would he be able to stand up against one of the most well-funded, well-equipped paramilitary forces in the world? And what would the United States do about it if he did try to do it? Would the United States support a military coup against a theocratic regime in Iran?
Well, I guess it would depend on what success would likely bring.
Well, it's you have to deal with the guy organizing the coup, and he's an old nemesis that I introduced back about 10 years ago, and I introduced him in a book called Silver Tower, and I introduced him in a book called Shadows of Steel. Mm-hmm. Readers are very familiar with him.
Oh yes,
General Bouzhazi, who actually tried to close off the Persian Gulf and actually tried to take on a American aircraft carrier battle group. He's a well-known nemesis to the United States Air Force and to Patrick McClanahan. They've tangled several times before.
Yes.
Now he wants McClanahan's help, that he has no one else to turn to. He's a disgraced former Iranian military general, regular military general. He's been ousted from the Revolutionary Guards Corps. No one believes him. No one wants to support him. He has no support from his friends in the military, from anywhere else in the world. He has no one else to turn to except someone who he knows has the power to help him, and that's Patrick McClanahan. Mm-hmm. So he actually makes a call to the White House where McClanahan is working, and he dares ask McClanahan, who he tried having him killed, having crossed swords with him several times before. He asks him for help to try to save Iran, and the president and the brain trust in the White House isn't sure whether or not they want to trust him. McClanahan certainly doesn't trust him, but this is the future of the Middle East. Whether or not they're going to bring down the theocratic regime, or if they want to put somebody in there, if they run the risk of putting somebody in charge even worse than the theocratic regime that's there now.
Exactly. It's always a gamble.
Absolutely.
In your opinion, Dale, we have always said, I think most U.S. presidents have said, that if somebody tried to close the Straits of Hormuz, cut off the oil supply, that we would we'd go all the way on that one. We'd use, if we had to, nuclear weapons. Is that still true today, or even more true?
We would be the second ones in there. We would have to deconflict our weapons with those of Israel.
Oh, yeah.
We would be several hours, maybe even several days behind Israel. We have plans going on right now. We've been conducting surveillance of Iran for several years now. Iran has been successful in shooting down several Predator unmanned aircraft flying over Iran doing reconnaissance missions, but that pales in comparison to what Israel has been doing in a pre-strike reconnaissance of Iran.
Yeah, we try to hold Israel down. We try to tell Israel, look, stay the hell out of it. Let us go do the job. Is that how you see this would come down, or do you think we would not be able to hold Israel down?
We would. Israel feels the pressure from Iran. Iran has a stated national security posture to take down Israel, and they know this. They know Iran is set up militarily to oppose them. They know who the enemy is. Iran knows who their main enemy is. Israel knows it also. So So both nations have active, ongoing intelligence and reconnaissance plans for a first strike against each other. That's been ongoing for many, many years. The United States is playing catch up. Now we're trying to do it more diplomatically. Israel has no diplomatic plans with Iran. We've had back channel negotiations with Iran for several years, right, easily since 2003, since the invasion of Iraq. But Israel has no such plans at all. They know.
Yeah, understandably. I mean, they're mortal enemies, so they don't even talk to them.
No, absolutely. And there's no reason for them to do that. They know that war is inevitable with Iran. If there isn't any major change in regime, if there is no major redirection of where the military outcome will happen, they know that there will be a fight in the next 1 to 5 years in Iran very easily.
Let me ask you this, Dale. Just looking practically at what you know about Iran, whether it's how much of a military threat is Iran, whether it's to Israel or the U.S. or anybody else, how much of a threat are they?
To the United States, a very, very small threat. It's a short-term economic threat to the United States, because if they do lash out, if they do attack oil shipments transiting the Straits of Hormuz and the Persian Gulf, they could wreak a lot of short-term economic consequences on the West, and that's a very serious consideration in the short term. They don't have a capability of striking the United States, not like North Korea, not like Russia. So they don't threaten us directly. They can't change our way of life, unlike Russia, unlike China, other nations. So they're not a direct threat to the United States. In the short term, they could cause some confusion and some havoc, but just like 9/11, we recovered from that after a relatively short period of time. They can do a lot of damage to American interests in the Middle East. They could do a lot of damage to American allies, certainly Israel, possibly Turkey, possibly other nations in Western Europe. So that's a major consideration for the United States.
On a regional basis, I'm sorry, Dale, on a regional basis, not threatening us directly, but on a regional basis, how much firepower does Iran possess? I mean, we hear stories about submarines, developing nuclear potential, chemical, biological, and so forth and so on. Regionally, how much of a threat are they?
They actually have a very limited capability. There are several air forces. The Air Force of the United Arab Emirates is larger than the Air Force of Iran. They have a very capable ground force. They have the Iranian Revolutionary Guards Corps is a very, very highly trained, well-equipped force. They're the equivalent of the U.S. Marines, about twice the size of the U.S. Marines. They're very capable and they're very well trained. That's the major threat to the area. But in the total overall capabilities, they have a very limited long-term strategic capability.
Okay.
But the short term, they could create a lot of havoc, and primarily in the Straits of Hormuz, the Persian Gulf, and the Arabian Sea area, they could create a lot of havoc, and they could really wipe out countries. They could wipe out Bahrain. They could wipe out Qatar. They could wipe out the United Arab Emirates with a massive strike against other nations in the Persian Gulf, and that's a serious consideration for the West.
It sure is.
Absolutely.
Do you think that we would be able to hold Israel back and we would do the military response, or do you think that Israel would say, that's it, we've had it, and just do what they're going to do?
I think Israel has a better finger on the pulse of what goes on in Iran and the Persian Gulf and the Middle East than we do. The United States relies on on Israel for the lion's share of the intelligence that we gather from that region. I think with our occupation of Iraq, that finally may be changing, but we rely on Israel for the bulk of our data that we get from the Middle East. And I think they have a firmer idea of what the threat is against them. And of course, they're on guard. They that to their nation is under day-to-day threat from nations like Syria, like Iran,
That's right.
and they need to keep on top of this stuff. If something were to happen, it will initiate with Israel and not with the United States.
Well, normally we try and keep Israel from doing something like that because, of course, of the fear of igniting all those other nations you mentioned in a full-fledged war against Israel.
Absolutely. Yeah. We need to try to control the situation. Israel's military intelligence services are all geared towards national survival. It's obviously not a factor for the United States. The survival of the United States doesn't hinge on what happens in the Middle East.
That's right.
Short term it does. Long term it doesn't. We look to nations like Russia towards actually what happens to the United States,
Right.
not to Iran. Israel is different. Israel looks at Iran day to day, hour to hour, because that concerns their
Oh,
survivability.
sure. I mean, they want Israel as a nation eradicated from the face of the earth.
Absolutely. And that's their national stated goal is the eradication of the Israeli state. That's a powerful statement. The United States has never said that, except maybe to Nazi Germany. We will eliminate Nazi Germany. We've never said that to the Soviet Union at the height of the Cold War. We've never said we want to eradicate the Soviet Union. That's a very powerful statement. And President Ahmadinejad has not just said it once, he said it several times. We will wipe Israel off the map. That's a very powerful statement. The entire military and the entire intelligence services of Israel are all geared towards to that reality.
Have you done traveling in that area?
I have years ago. I visited Turkey. I visited Israel. It's a when you visit Israel, if you haven't been
Yes,
there,
I have.
it's a that when you realize I looked at it from the eyes of an ex-Air Force officer, the defense of Israel. When you could be on the upper floor of the Hyatt in Tel Aviv. And you can see the enemy. You can see the Mediterranean Sea, and you can see the West Bank from the upper floor of a hotel. You realize how absolutely indefensible that nation is. When you stand at the Capitol and you realize an aircraft with a nuclear bomb on it can fly within radar coverage to your location in 5 or 6 seconds, that's just mind-boggling. We
That's
don't
right.
we
And
have no conception of that in the United States.
also when you walk on the streets of just about any Israeli town or city, almost everybody is armed. Everybody's carrying submachine guns around. It's unbelievable. But when you look at what you just said about the stated goal of Iran, it's not so unbelievable.
Absolutely.
It's a nation that is in power. Its very survival, minute to minute, is a concern of all the citizens, and you can sure see it when you walk the streets. All right. Dale Brown is my guest, and we'll be back in a moment. This is Coast to Coast AM. I'm Art Bell. If you are a listener to this program, then there's a very good chance you enjoy the kind of books that Dale Brown writes, techno thrillers, and they're just absolutely the best. If you have not yet become a Dale Brown fan, actually, I'm shocked if you haven't. And just in case you haven't, then you have a wonderful, well, I don't know, you got about 19 books out there that you're absolutely going to love. He's the man we're interviewing right now, Dale Brown. We'll be right back. Well, all right, once again, Dale Brown. Dale, do you think the United States is on the verge of going to war with Iran?
Dale, there's no question in my mind that we will, within the next 1 to 5 years, we will have a conflict with Iran. I think it's inevitable. Iran wants to keep on with its nuclear production. They're ramping it up. They'll have the capability. I've researched this when I did Shadows of Steel back 10 years ago. That's when Iran was first recognized as having a nuclear program, and that was 10 years ago. That was there was no doubt in my mind that Iran wanted to take its place as the leader of the Middle East, as the leader of the Shiite movement in the world, and they wanted their rightful place as the leader of the Islamic world, and I think nuclear weapons is the way that they want to achieve that that goal. And the United States, even in past administrations, the United States wants to stop Iran from having that kind of dominance. And I think a confrontation is inevitable. They don't want to stop. They see their opportunity. They see the United States bogged down in Iraq. They see the United States on the ropes. They see weakness in Israel with the confrontation with Hezbollah in Lebanon, and they see this as their opportunity to take the rightful place as the leader of the Middle East.
And so inevitable somewhere between one and 5 years.
Yes, within 1 to 5 years, I believe active planning. You know, there was a few news reports back a few months ago saying, well, the United States has an attack plan against Iran. Well, when I was in the Air Force back 20 years ago, we had bags ready with B-52 strike missions against countries like Iran. When the hostage crisis erupted in Iran, we had strike missions planned against Tehran. There was no doubt about it. We have ongoing active reconnaissance and intelligence gathering going on, and I think a confrontation because Iran refuses to back down. I see some promise now with the back channel negotiations now going more overt rather than all back channel negotiations. We actually have State Department level officials meeting with Iranian officials, and I see that as a positive step. But the total thrust of the Iranian government and the theocratic regime tells me that they have no desire to change, because they see an opportunity to take a leadership position in the Middle East.
And all right, Dale, let me ask you this. If we hit Iran, which I agree with you, I think it's inevitable, do you believe that it would be a series of surgical kind of strikes to take and knock their nuclear capability back years and years, or would we be after regime change?
We don't. I don't see the target. I've researched this for years now. I don't see that the target complexes actually going after their nuclear research and development facilities. I don't see those as the normal targets. And I get a real kick out of all these commentators getting on network news and talking about how difficult it would be to bomb these research and development facilities. They say, well, it would be useless to attack Iran because they have 32 different facilities, most of them buried underground, and that to the United States would be impossible. It would be impossible for the United States to destroy all those facilities. Those would not be our targets. Our target priority, at least for the Air Force, would be to go after command and control, air defense, and facilities like that. We would go after after the quote-unquote normal target complexes, which would be airfields, air defense facilities, the relatively short-range strike facilities like the missile facilities, the Chinese-based missile the anti-ship missile facilities that we're really worried about that would go against the tankers transiting to the Strait of Hormuz. That would be those would be the targets that the United States Air Force would go after. Once we get control of the airspace over Iran, they would hopefully realize that the United States would have free rein to fly over any part of Iran that we chose, and that we could take out the nuclear research and development facilities at our leisure. But we wouldn't go after those facilities at first. We would go after command and control and air defense facilities. We would take those out, and we would establish air superiority over Iran, and then we could dictate terms to them.
Which, of course, we did with Iraq very quickly. And while we're on the subject, we're pretty deeply now into the Iraq War. And I'd love to get your comments on it. What are we doing right, and what are we doing wrong?
Well, I have a lot of criticism against the current war in Iraq. I believe that we need to have forces on the ground in Iraq, and I think that's very important for the war against radical Islam. The whole notion about the war on terror, I think, is a misnomer, and I wish they would recategorize what they describe as the war that we're fighting. It's not a war on terrorism. It's a war against exactly what struck us on 9/11, and that was radical Islam. That's what we're going after. That's what we need to control. That's what we need to dominate, and the Middle East is the heart of that, and Iraq is in the heart of the Middle East. That's where the United States needs to be. And we don't need any interference. We don't need other nations telling us we can't operate from their airfields that we built. We don't want any nations in that region of the world telling us we can't launch strikes against targets. So we need to have free rein in that area of the world, and that's what we're doing in Iraq. Now, I don't think that we need to be in Baghdad. I disagreed with the whole strategy of bringing 150,000 troops, most of which are in Baghdad, most of which are in the green zone, protecting the green zone. Mm-hmm. We don't need to be doing that. I disagree with that strategy. I did agree with bringing down Saddam Hussein. I think he was stirring up trouble. But he wasn't the worst problem. The worst problem were in the neighboring countries of Iraq, not inside Iraq itself. If anything, I wouldn't call Iraq an ally of the United States, but they were a counterweight to the real enemies against the United States.
Well, if you call it a war between the West and radical Islam, you get awfully close to saying it's a war between the West and Islam. And and maybe ultimately that's what it's going to be, Dale. Is that your view?
That's what it is. That's exactly what it is. It's the same thing that we were when we're fighting communism during the Cold War. It's the same thing when we're fighting Nazism during World War II. It's the very same thing. And for some reason, people are afraid to categorize it because we're talking about a religion. And the idea that the United States would go to war against a religion is just offensive to a lot of Americans. But it's not a religion. It's a bastardization of a religion that goes beyond religious tenets.
How much of Islam, in your opinion, Dale, is radicalized? I mean, that's a very, very important question.
It's the basis of the radicalism. It's the basis. It exists. and it's there, and that's what initially motivates a lot of the fighters, but it's what they morph the religion into that we're really fighting. But whatever it is, we have to acknowledge that the evil exists, and we have to have the will, we have to have the national will and the national resolve to go against it. And that means putting troops on the ground, in harm's way, on patrol. My youngest brother is out there right now. I thought my brother Jim, being a lieutenant colonel in the U.S. Army, would be free from that. I just got a picture of him on the ground in Bakuba on patrol with a rifle in his hand, with all the battle rattle on. He's a lieutenant colonel doing a patrol through the streets of Bakuba during the current operation. It was amazing to me. I thought, secretly, personally, myself, I thought maybe my youngest brother was safe because he's a light colonel. Mm-hmm. He's an operations officer. He should be in the rear. He should be in headquarters. He's the second in command of the brigade. He'll be safe. This is his sixth time in the Middle East, his second time in Iraq in the past 4 years. I thought maybe he would be safe from all this stuff. And sure enough, just two nights ago, I get an email photograph of him on patrol in the streets of Bakuba during the current operation. As sad, as fearful I am of him being out there, him and his brigade has lost seven men in the past 3 months. His base has lost 14 in the past 3 months since their current deployment.
Wow.
As fearful as I am of having him out there, I'm glad he's out there because we're fighting a war against radical Islam, and the place to fight it is in Iraq. Not because the enemy was in Iraq, but because that's a central location where 150,000 troops, 2,000 tanks and armored vehicles cannot just reach out and touch Saddam Hussein and the fighters inside Iraq, but they can reach out and they can touch all those radicals in Iran, in Syria, in Lebanon, in Jordan, mm-hmm. in Saudi Arabia, in Kuwait. I mean, name all those countries. That's why the United States needs to be in Iraq. We need to establish a presence in Iraq. We need to stay there. I mean, if it takes 10 years, if it takes 20 years, if it takes 60 years, exactly how long we've been in Germany when we were committed to fight Nazism and then communism, that's what we need to do in Iraq. And we've started it. It's a tough battle compared to what we've sacrificed in World War II and the Cold War. We've really sacrificed nothing. I mean, that's very hard to tell to people who have lost friends and family members there. But we need to do it. We need to have a presence there. We need to stay there, and we need to stay committed. And I wish the politicians in Washington would. I think they realize. I personally think they realize what the mission is. They just don't want to admit it in public, so they don't want to sacrifice their political future to say that.
Dale, even our president has been very, very careful to delineate between radical Islam and Islam. Now, I'm beginning to wonder how successful the radicals have been in posturing all of Islam against the West. In other words, how much of Islam is becoming radicalized?
Yes, I think it's a tightrope. It's a public relations and it's a political tightrope that I think that we need to stop walking it. We need to stop doing it. We need to stop calling it a war on terror, and we need to call it exactly what it is. It's a war on radical Islam. It's not a war on Islam. It's not a war on peaceful, nonviolent people. It's a war on a specific group of people who are very well funded, very well organized. Some of their organizers and some of their fund sources are allies or they're beneficiaries of the United States. They provide oil to the United States. Mm-hmm. They have a lot of wealth. They're very important to the economic success and vitality of the United States, but they become enemies because they balance their own political agendas, their own political survivability with the radicals. And I think we need to break away from that. We need to get away from that agenda, and we need to 9/11 has completely changed the landscape, and we need to realize that. Everybody in the United States and in the West needs to realize where the new war is. And just like it was with Nazism and with communism, we have to realize that we have to generate ourselves into thinking that there's a new enemy out there. It's not communism, it's not Nazism, it's radical Islam. And mm-hmm. and we need to approach it, and we need to fight it, just like we did with Nazism and with communism. We need to have organizations. We need to have military units in place, just like we created the Strategic Air Command, specifically to counter to the Soviet Union and the rise of the strategic capabilities of the Soviet Union. We created the Strategic Air Command. We need to create a unit. We need to create an infrastructure to go against radical Islam, and whether or not that's the Special Operations Command, whether or not that's a whole new unit that needs to be created. I bring that up in Strike Force. I create a new unit in Strike Force, mostly based in space, that specifically to go and support units like the military coup that takes place in Iran. We need to create units and we need to create a whole generation of brain trust to go against to be able to fight that war.
In real life, Dale, how likely is a coup in Iran?
I think it's very likely. I think the people of Iran are very sophisticated. They were created to that way. I almost hate to say it, but by the Shah of Iran, mm-hmm. he brought Iran into the 20th century. He used the wealth that Iran accumulated and that mm-hmm. Iran earned for itself with its ally, with alliance with the United States. He brought Iran into the 20th century, and I think a lot of Iranians
don't like being driven back.
Yes, I believe that the most Iranians don't like the direction that the country has taken.
And that would make it ripe for a coup. All right, Dale, hold tight. We're at the top of the hour. My guest is Dale Brown, and I'm sure that he's written something that you've read. And I've read just about every single thing that he's written. Quite an author. From the high desert and the great American Southwest, I'm Art Bell.